Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with questions arising out of the paucity of Attorney General Barr's summary of the Mueller report and the special counsel's apparent punting on whether Trump obstructed justice when he did so in plain view and on many occasions, which has left many wondering whether the fix was in. And the larger question, following so little resulting from so much effort, so many indictments, and such a mountain of evidence in the press and public arena, appears to be whether America's justice system is incapable of challenging real power. David Diane, the executive editor of the American Prospect, joins us to discuss his article advice, Trump Never Had Anything to Fear from an Insider Like Robert Mueller, and whether white-collar crime and public corruption have effectively been written out of the U.S. criminal code. With no consequences for those who brought about the Wall Street crash of 2008, when Robert Mueller was the FBI director at the time, now we are witnessing no apparent consequences for the White House, where in fact a victory celebration is going on for having a head of the President's National Security Council plead guilty, Trump's first campaign manager sentenced to over 7 years in prison, a number of aides indicted, and his personal lawyer on his way to jail. This leads to David Diane's conclusion that the issue of equal justice for all should be a major campaign focus in 2020, or we haven't learned anything. Then, with the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello, remarking today in a CNN interview that, quote, if the bully gets close, I'll punch the bully in the mouth. We'll examine the strained relations between the Trump White House and the beleaguered island of Puerto Rico, now facing cuts in food stamps and a diversion of aid for needed reconstruction following the devastating hurricanes to be used to build Trump's wall. Charles Venator Santiago, professor of Latino politics with the Department of Political Science and the Institute for Puerto Rican Studies at the University of Connecticut and author of the forthcoming book, Less Than Equal, A History of the Extension of U.S. Citizenship to Puerto Rico, joins us. Then finally, we will speak with an expert on Saudi Arabia and the ruling Al-Saud family, Ali Al-Ahmed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He joins us to discuss Jared Kushner's appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee today and the demand by the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee for a briefing from Secretary of State Pompeo on what went on in Jared Kushner's recent secret meetings with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, from which other top U.S. officials were excluded. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, David Diane, the executive editor of the American Prospect and a contributing writer to The Intercept and The New Republic, among other publications, the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize. He is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and most recently, Fat Cat, the Steve Mnuchin story. And he has an article of advice, Trump Never Had Anything to Fear from an Insider Like Robert Mueller. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Diane.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And it would seem to me that as well as Mueller being a lifelong Republican and a very conservative one at that, Barr, of course, his boss, the Attorney General, I mean, essentially, he auditioned for the job. And I don't think Trump could have chosen a better person who's dedicated to presidential power, because it was, after all, it was William Barr who covered up the Iran-Contra for George H.W. and covered up a bunch of presidential misdeeds and gave a lot of pardons out. So it's almost like he was auditioning for the job back then.
Well, and his more immediate audition was a 19-page report about how the Mueller investigation and special counsel investigations more generally should not proceed. So I think he showed his loyalty through that unsolicited report that Barr made. But, of course, I obviously have no idea what's in the Mueller report, and neither do you, neither does anybody right now. We have a four-page summary that uses about less than 100 words of what's in the report. But what we do know is that the indictments that were more expected ended up not being made. And the point I make in this piece is a larger one about the fact that we just have forgotten or choose not to indict powerful people in this country. We have a two-tiered system of justice, one for the rich and well-connected, and one for everybody else. And for those who thought that the Mueller investigation was somehow going to be any different, I think got a bit of an awakening when the investigation was closed down.
So that's what you mean in your article in Vice, David Dayan. The truth is that America's justice system is incapable of challenging real power.
That's correct. And we've seen this over and over again, whether it's the lack of indictments for lying us into the Iraq War or the torture that was carried out by the CIA, or the more recently the collapse of the American financial system, which was done because of a mountain of fraud and practically no major top-ranking executive from any of the big banks was indicted for that conduct. I mean, you can just go on and on down the line. I refer in my piece to an FBI investigation that I know about because I got some documents through the Freedom of Information Act about it, into this misconduct with the major banks around foreclosures, where millions of documents were delivered that were fraudulent and fake, and they were used to take people's homes away. And that investigation just mysteriously vanished at one point. And that was at a time when Robert Mueller was running the FBI. So, you know, whether or not you have a belief in Mueller's integrity or whatever, it doesn't have to be that he's a corrupt person. He's just marinated within this persistent view of the world from the law enforcement community that is clearly biased against indicting very powerful people. And that's a combination of laws that have narrowed white-collar crime and what you can actually indict. It includes charging guidelines that are very restrictive, and it includes a sort of cultural milieu where prosecutors and defense counsel come largely from the same group. Sometimes they work at the same places or had in the past, and there's a sort of willingness to provide aid and comfort, let's say, to suspects so that they're not challenged very directly. And I just think that we need to reckon with the fact that this is bigger than Donald Trump or anyone else. It's a persistent problem with our justice system, and we need to come to terms with it.
And again, I'm speaking with David Dayan, who's executive editor of The American Prospect and a contributing writer to The Intercept and The New Republic, among other publications. He's the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize and the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and most recently, Fat Cat, the Steve Mnuchin story. And he has an article advice, Trump never had anything to fear from an insider like Robert Mueller. Now, so I'm certainly not defending the FBI, but they did, obviously, after 9/11, they transferred, I believe, about 500 agents from Wall Street into counterterrorism.
That's correct.
And then on top of that, it seems that there's an irony here vis-a-vis, and of course we, as you pointed out earlier, David, we haven't seen the Mueller report. It's at least 300 pages. All we've seen is a four-page summary, which I think was an inside fix, to basically shape the public narrative, so enabling Trump to do a victory lap, which is what he's doing. And presumably, you know, one hopes that we'll see something that won't be completely shredded and blacked out. But one of the things that came up in Cohen's testimony, and apparently the Southern District of New York is looking into these charges, was how Trump inflated his assets in order to get loans from Deutsche Bank, and that's prompted an inquiry. Well, that is apparently pretty routine in terms of white-collar crime, and I'm told that for prosecutors, that's a slam dunk. That's like one of the easiest cases to make. So,
well, we will see what if that indeed becomes a slam dunk. I'll give you another slam dunk, and that's the crimes that Paul Manafort was accused of. He obviously did not go by the guidelines of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, but he had been doing that for decades. And it was only the spotlight of the Mueller investigation and the clear intention to get people like Manafort to flip that called attention to this crime in plain sight, this violation that had been done forever by lobbyists, whatever their proclivities, whatever party or particular issue they supported. And it was just being done, just you know, by pretty much every lobbyist on K Street. Now, what we know is that plea deal, which ended up falling apart, but all the other plea deals were put in order to get information from these individuals so that they could use that information for some higher purpose to find someone up the chain. And what we know is that those indictments did not happen. And so what information was given and why was leniency given to individuals who copped a plea if that information wasn't put to any purpose? It just seems like this is part and parcel with how our white-collar investigations go in this country, which usually do not result in many major operations. And it doesn't even have to be white-collar prosecutions. I mean, look at what Trump's labor secretary did in creating a plea deal with Jeffrey Epstein, who was a very rich person accused of multiple instances of sexual assault of minors. I mean, this happens over and over and over again. There is a different standard put towards the wealthy and well-connected relative to, you know, somebody who's from a poor family walking down the street with a joint. There's just a difference there. And I really think that this situation where people poured a lot of hope into this reversing somehow, that white collar criminals were finally going to be rounded up, or that wealthy individuals were finally going to be called to account. You know, the fact that it didn't happen, at least not yet, I think is something that needs to actually be a 2020 issue. Because I don't think the country can continue to abide by having this unequal system of justice under the law.
Well, Epstein's case is just appalling, and the way that it was handled by Acosta, now Secretary of Labor, particularly choosing the one case against a 16-year-old where there were multiple cases of rape and sex trafficking of 13 and 14-year-old girls. So he was given all kinds of breaks. But it's worth noting, when you talk about the different standard for the rich and for the rest of us, he was able to afford Alan Dershowitz and Ken Starr as his lawyers. I mean, I was just listening to Ken Starr sort of pontificating in a sort of that reasoned voice about the difference between his jihad against Clinton and this current case with Mueller. And, you know, I kept saying to the radio, well, why don't you ask him about why he took all that money to get a horrible sex offender who was a child molester or a child trafficker? I mean, they don't come much lower. But that is a little bit off the case here. What's your sense then of when there's clearly more to come from the Southern District of New York, and there are other inquiries, I believe. There's some referrals going on with the all of the various tentacles of this Mueller inquiry. And of course, Cohen himself was a referral from Mueller to the Southern District of New York. Do you think the door is closed on the Mueller case?
Well, Ian, I mean, I guess there's the old adage that if you have no expectations, then you can never be disappointed. I mean, I would be happy to be wrong about this, and that if crimes were committed, that they're actually prosecuted in a diligent manner with the requisite amount of deterrent and punishment that fit the crime. But I gotta say, I just haven't seen it. I didn't see it for the largest consumer fraud in American history, which was the global financial crisis and the foreclosure crisis. I haven't seen it with powerful people from just going on down the line, from Trump and his associates to Jeffrey Epstein, as we mentioned, to Bob Kraft, to Bob McDonnell, who was the governor of Virginia, who was indicted and convicted in a public corruption case that the Supreme Court threw out. The Obama administration, under them, corporate prosecutions got so completely out of whack that they had to rewrite a memo to say, hey, prosecutors, could you actually bother to try to charge individuals with these crimes? I mean, corporations don't do these things of their own volition. Somebody within that corporate structure must have committed the crime, and we got to get to the bottom of this. I mean, we've seen this just for so long in our country. I would like there to be a situation where Mueller somehow had the resources and the political and institutional will to actually reverse this trend, but I was very skeptical. And as we sit here right now, I have to say that that skepticism was vindicated. I hope it is not in the future, but I'm just not very hopeful.
Well, one of the congresswomen, Jackie Speier, I believe she's on the Intel committee, is now saying that she thinks that not only the fix-in vis-a-vis Barr, that there's a collusion between Barr and Mitch McConnell, but presumably we'll wait and see whether anything develops on that. But in your article, Advice, David Diane, Trump never had anything to fear from an insider like Robert Mueller. You say that, particularly in terms of obstruction of justice, Trump appeared to carry out obstruction of justice in plain view. I think, you know, he's the guy that said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. That seems to be
a serious question, though, Ian, that I think Mueller is going to have to answer. And if he ever is brought before a House committee, I would love to hear the answer, because the entire point of doing a special counsel is that you take questions that are sensitive out of the political realm, like obstruction of justice by a president and his administration. You don't punt that off to the attorney general who was handpicked by that president to make the determination. And the reason why Mueller would have decided not to draw a conclusion, despite whatever evidence he had and the evidence that most of us saw with our own eyes on obstruction, is really baffling and dispiriting, because it suggests that my initial kind of supposition on this was correct, that there just wasn't a will to actually go where the evidence led.
Well, that's one of the great puzzlements about Trump in general, is that if you read the really well-researched books that are out there by Craig Unger and the Associated Press's Seth Hettner and the Washington Post's Greg Miller, it's a litany of Trump's ties to Russian organized crime, to vast amounts of money laundering through Trump Towers and other Trump properties, along with the casinos that were a money laundry for Soviet money stolen from Soviet coffers, then laundered by Russian organized crime for the benefit of the KGB. It's an extraordinary story. And one wonders why he skated on all of those things. And I suppose it didn't hurt that he's had a lifelong close friendship with his now TV attorney, Rudolph Giuliani, who, of course, was the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York.
Right. I mean, I think that Mueller, just with respect to this investigation, to say nothing of, you know, others that might crop up, Mueller clearly took a very narrow view of his mandate, that it was about events meddling by the Russians within the scope of the election. I think that the things that you described, to the extent they're true, speak to motive for that to happen, or for that to be the event that the Russians believed that Trump would act in their interest. But clearly, even though those things were available, because if you read the sort of what Mueller was charged with, he was advised to look at links where and follow that wherever they led. Certainly that a narrow mandate didn't stop Ken Starr. We know that, right? So, you know, the fact that he didn't just tells me that there was kind of a lid placed on this. And it was just not seen as something that was fertile ground for inquiry. And that speaks to how we've, you know, just minimized and narrowed the ability to get at this major set of unprosecuted crime that goes on in corporate boardrooms all over this country on practically a daily basis.
Well, just in closing, it also seems to me that maybe another motive, apart from the kind of country club comedy that these traditional Republicans like Barr and Mueller have with, you know, corporate titans, etc., is the extent to which the Republican brand is being saved here. You know, had Trump been indicted, I'm sure it would have damaged the entire Republican brand in 2020. I don't have any proof of that, but the feeling you get about the Supreme Court is similar to what I'm just saying, that rather than compete with the demographics that are happening, which they're afraid of, it seems that the conservative justices on the Supreme Court have given the Republicans a leg up through sanctioning voter suppression and allowing unlimited money via Citizens United. And,
I would just say, Ian, that this needs to be a 2020 issue. The issue is corruption and unprosecuted crime. And we need to hear from the candidates who presume that they're going to challenge Donald Trump in the general election from the Democratic side on how they're going to end this two-tiered system of justice, end this situation where who you know is more important than what you did. What can be done? Is it congressional laws that reaffirm what the charging statute should be? Is it changes to departmental guidelines? Is it bringing in leadership at the law enforcement agencies from different parts of America, not from the corporate law sector? What is it that you're going to do to end this situation where we have massive amounts of corruption, massive amounts of corporate and white-collar crime, and it seemingly nothing happens about that? So I really think that this now has the potential to be a signature issue in 2020, and I'm happy that you're interested in it, and I hope you keep on it.
Well, I hope some of those candidates that are running for president, and there's a hell of a lot of them, are listening to you. So I thank you for joining us, David Dayan.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Dayan, who's the executive editor of The American Prospect and a contributing writer to The Intercept and The New Republic. He's the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize and the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and most recently, Fat Cat, the Steve Mnuchin story. And he has an article advice, Trump never had anything to fear from an insider like Robert Mueller. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the remark today on CNN by Puerto Rico's governor that if the bully gets close, I'll punch the bully in the mouth. Police and thieves in the street. Oh, yes. Scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition. But the next generation will be. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Venator Santiago, professor of Latino politics, public law, and political theory, who holds a joint appointment with the Department of Political Science and the Institute for Puerto Rican and Latino Studies at the University of Connecticut. And his forthcoming book is Less Than Equal, A History of the Extension of U.S. Citizenship to Puerto Rico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Venator Santiago.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossello, has really stirred things up. I guess he's here in Washington. He's been stood up by the White House. they don't want to meet with him, but he did say on CNN, and it's clearly a reference to Trump, if the bully gets close, I'll punch the bully in the mouth. So I assume, Charles, that that's not going to help him get a meeting with Trump.
No, but I also want to contextualize that those comments are also referring or also meant for a Puerto Rican audience, not so much for the U.S. audience.
Right, but there have been meetings with Peter Navarro, the trade minister, and they've been very contentious. My understanding is that Navarro told Rosello, you guys have to effing stop with meeting requests. And then he went on to say, your governor is effing things up. So that's what the attitude of the White House. What are they talking about? I mean, Navarro is a pretty odd character to begin with. Nobody has much respect for his scholarship, and he has pretty fringe views, but he has a lot of power and influence in this White House.
So let me give you three contexts that might be helpful. The first is that the federal aid that was meant for Puerto Rico hasn't trickled down fast enough, and there have been lots of obstacles primarily created by the Puerto Rican government and their ineptitude and mismanagement, and this is tied to local scandals, but also by the federal bureaucracy. In a sense, there's this complaint about lack of funding that has been promised for Puerto Rico and not arrived. The second is that within the past couple weeks, both Governor Rosselló testified in the Senate's Natural Resources Committee, and then his Secretary of Housing testified last week in the House Committee on Financial Oversight, again, complaining that federal resources haven't trickled down to Puerto Rico. So there's been some public shaming of the federal government. In addition to that, President Trump has indicated that he wants to use some of the money for Puerto Rico either to assist in the border constructions or to assist states in the United States in their rebuilding efforts. And then the final issue is really this sort of posturing type of politics, that Governor Rosselló is starting to prepare for elections, and he needs to posture a little bit more and show that he has some sort of connection or influence with the with the President of the United States, and that's not happening.
Well, the person who's running against for governor in the upcoming elections is the mayor of San Juan, right, who's really Trump's nemesis. So I guess Trump is between a guy that wants to punch him in the mouth and a woman who has been calling him out for the longest time. I can't imagine Trump's happy with either choice.
Well, but again, on the governor's part, there's a little bit of theatrics going on. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember, during the initial visit of Trump to the island, there's a sort of agreement around the deaths, low death count, and Governor Rosselló was sort of appeasing President Trump in the public media, despite all the flubs by President Trump. So in that sense, part of what's going on is that Governor Rosselló has to sort of play the theatrics. Second, or related to that, is this question of what Trump expects people that are, I don't know, considered to be strong will do. And here the Judge Kavanaugh hearings are an example of what Trump expects from either somebody who supports him or works with him. So in some sense, Governor Rosselló is trying to sort of fit that mold of somebody who's going to stand up and fight in the same vein that Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh put on the theatrics in Congress about drinking beer and being tough and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Well, Trump, of course, or at least the White House, have not denied that remarks that Trump made to Republican senators recently when he was basically saying, why are we giving money to Puerto Rico? I need that money to build my wall. Has that sort of started this round of... but surely the problems with Puerto Rico and its extraordinary amount of debt go back some time, do they not? And wasn't it Obama who set up this regime with that Congress and White House representatives essentially deciding what the budget of Puerto Rico is?
Yeah. So that's a very important point that I was going to mention, and I'm glad you raised it. So the financial crisis of the island hit bottom sometime around 2012, 2014. Beat bottom, in other words, Puerto Rico just was unable to pay its debt. So by 2016, Congress passed a Fiscal Oversight and Management Board to essentially regulate the local economy. that board imposed a series of austerity measures that essentially destroy the local economy. And by their own admission, the economy won't grow until the year 2026. In doing so, part of the strategy was that they were going to rely on federal funding. And they were estimating anywhere from $90 to $100 billion would trickle down in financial aid to assist Puerto Rico in rebuilding. So, and that's partly what Trump is responding to, that there's a local strategy that relies on almost $100 billion. Now, part of the problem, in addition to the austerity approach, or the trickle-down economics approach, is that there's a recent decision in, by the district court judge appointed to manage the cases arising out of the sort of oversight board, where Wall Street bondholders were guaranteed a 93% or 94% return on their investments, whereas, on the debt that they had purchased, whereas local bondholders were going to get a return of 56% on their investment. A return meaning the amount of money that they're going to get based on what their investments were. So in other words, what ended up happening is that instead of allocating money from the local budget to rebuild Puerto Rico or to grow the economy, that money is now going to bondholders. Now, or Wall Street bondholders, not even the local bondholders. So I think Trump in some ways is responding to this idea of moving money towards the private sector that is not doing anything for Puerto Rico, because federal fundings are enabling the Fiscal Oversight Board to essentially use local money to essentially pay bondholders, wealthy bondholders in Wall Street, as opposed to build the economy.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Benito Santiago, professor of Latino politics, public law, and political theory, who holds a joint appointment with the Department of Political Science and the Institute for Puerto Rican and Latino Studies at the University of Connecticut. And his forthcoming book is Less Than Equal, A History of the Extension of U.S. Citizenship to Puerto Rico. Now, so the priority is, of course, to make bondholders on Wall Street rich, but the expense of Puerto Ricans who they're cutting back on food stamps. And I understand that Puerto Rico has the highest percentage of any states, not that it's a state, but any territory or state's population on food stamps.
So again, depends on what data you're using. Mm-hmm. But anywhere between 40 and 50% of the population are living in poverty. And this has been exacerbated after the hurricane. And about 10% live in disability, rely on disability benefits. So we're talking about 60%, anywhere from 50 to 60% of the population is living in poverty and rely on federal subsidies. Now, Puerto Rico has a population that's larger than 22 states. So compared to the other states, the jurisdiction in Puerto Rico is receiving requires a disproportionate amount of funding for social services, food stamps, housing, Section 8 housing, and other local vouchers. Now, the challenge is that all funding that goes to Puerto Rico, social welfare funding, is capped. So part of what's at stake here is trying to uncap or release additional funding to address the crisis created by the hurricane. And when you start calculating those numbers, the amount of people who will receive social benefits just to survive is staggering compared to any other state in the union.
So the other issue that's sort of hovering there, of course, is the issue of statehood. And I understand that you're involved in that, some of those negotiations, or at least in contact with the senators and congresspeople involved in it. On the surface, and a number of Democrats running for president have called for statehood, Beto O'Rourke among them. My understanding is that that's surely dead on arrival, not just with the White House, but with the Republican-controlled Senate, simply because the Republicans don't want two new Democratic Senate seats. Isn't it that simple?
Yes. So today, or yesterday, rather, Representative Darren Soto from Florida introduced a bill calling for a 90-day statehood mission of Puerto Rico. And this is supported by the resident commissioner. In both the Senate and the House, he's received public information that statehood or plebiscite is not a priority for this Congress, or at least the session, because they have to deal with the crisis. And in the case of Florida and elsewhere, both Senator Rubio and President Trump have said no to statehood for three basic reasons. One, a statehood would make it illegal to have a fiscal oversight board, and Puerto Rico's bankrupt. That would mean that upwards of $150 to $160 billion would be in the air, because it would be illegal to have an oversight board that regulates the local economy to ensure that that money gets paid. That's a staggering debt. In addition to that, Democrats are likely to win most seats, and that would entail granting 7 seats, 2 in the Senate and 5 in the House, to the Democratic Party. So surely Republicans aren't going to do that. And then 3, there's just no support among states to reapportion the 5 seats from the House, particularly larger states like Texas and Florida, who would lose a seat and lose the money that comes with a seat, a congressional seat.
So is this a stalemate?
No, it's been going on for 120 years. I think this is more of the usual.
I think you've answered the question.
I don't see any change. I think what a lot of Puerto Ricans are coming to grips is that in recent years, Congress and the Supreme Court have essentially limited the powers of the local Commonwealth government, and they've seen that as essentially a slap in the face. So given that Puerto Rican government has its powers are being constrained, they're seeing statehood as an option out. They're not looking at independence for the most part, but it's a way to sort of liberate themselves from the sort of grasp of Congress and the Supreme Court.
But wasn't there a vote in Puerto Rico about statehood? And even though it got over 90% in favor of statehood, I think there was only a participation of about 20 or 30%. Do I have that right?
Yes. So in the aftermath of the 2012 plebiscite, President Obama called for a series of follow-up plebiscites. And the 2017 plebiscite was supposed to be certified by the Department of Justice, but the local government made up all kinds of ballots that were inconsistent with Congress's and the Department of Justice requests. So they held a plebiscite on June 10, 2017, and only 23% of the electorate showed up to vote, and 22% of those of the electorate voted for statehood, or 97%. Now, the problem is that the standard for statehood, the bar for statehood that has been placed by both conservatives and liberals alike, requires that 60% of the electorate or more, or 65% of the electorate, vote in affirmative for statehood. Now, that's not a strong rule, or it's not a rule set in stone, but that's a political expectation. So when you only have 22% supporting statehood or showing up to the polls to vote for statehood, Congress is not taking that vote very seriously, especially when it refuses to ratify or affirm that particular plebiscite.
But how do you explain the attitudes of Ramon Nieves, who once served in Puerto Rico Senate with the Popular Democratic Party? He said, "We, the Puerto Rican people, have our own national identity. We do not consider ourselves Americans, since we have our own culture, traditions, and languages." Is that sentiment in any way widespread? I mean, it would seem to contradict all of what the candidates running for governor and what I understand to be the overall sentiment of the Puerto Rican people, which is that, you know, we're supposed to be American citizens, but we can't vote.
Well, you know, it's a tricky question. And I say that because part of living Puerto Rico is sort of accepting the sort of dual identity. If you ask the average Puerto Rican, are they willing to give up their U.S. citizenship? I'm willing to bet that upwards of 90% would say no. We don't. Even if Puerto Rico became independent, we'd like to remain citizens for a range of reasons. At the same time, if you ask the statehood party, particularly the governor of Puerto Rico's father, who was the former governor of Rosillo, whether they'd like to give up their Olympic team, former governor of Rosillo is on record saying, if we become a state, we're going to retain a separate Puerto Rican Olympic team, even if we're the 51st state of the United States. So you have, at a cultural level, a lot of Puerto Ricans want to affirm a sense of difference in identity. But at a political level, they still want to maintain a link, not only through citizenship, but also through a sense of belonging to one of the most powerful nations in the world.
Well, how do they feel about President Trump? I mean, if the governor is saying, you know, that statement about if the bully gets close, I'll punch the bully in the mouth, which you say he's playing for the local audience in Puerto Rico, I can't get out of my memory Trump tossing paper towels when he went down there. And as you mentioned, the governor went along with Trump in playing down the enormous death toll. At the time, they said there was only 16 people died as a result of the devastating hurricane. Now it's over, 3,000 or something?
One study suggests that.
Yeah. So the question would be then, to my mind, I think Trump is quite racist in his attitude. Tossing paper towels was pretty damn patronizing. But we know that he refers to countries as S-holes, and that's, I think that's an element that we have to deal with here.
Yeah, no. The rhetoric that Trump embraces, whether it's the border walls, whether it's the lies about immigration and crime, and their lies because they're statistically inaccurate and false, or whether the way he describes Puerto Ricans, Latinos, or non-white populations, and his tacit supports for white supremacists, as we saw from his comments in the Charlottesville incident, clearly define sort of how Puerto Ricans in some ways see him or reject him. I think if you look at the latest poll, and the latest, I mean last year's poll by the Washington Post and Kaiser Foundation, the average Puerto Rican at the time, right after the hurricane, felt that the inadequate and slow response by the federal government under the leadership of President Trump was likely based on his racist attitudes toward Puerto Ricans. So in that sense, yes, I think there's been some brewing resentment in the island because a lot of Puerto Ricans feel they're U.S. citizens and they should be entitled to some sort of support or comparable support to the mainland. And they're not getting that. And plus, they're getting policies that are, in some cases, harming the island.
Well, let's hope that those that fled the island because of the devastation and moved to Central Florida will vote. And that's the irony, isn't it? You can't vote in Puerto Rico, but if you move to the United States, you can.
Well, you can't really vote in the United States either. Right. Remember, the president is selected by an electoral college. The popular vote is part of it. So in that sense, what we're seeing is the migration of Puerto Ricans to the mainland can only have an impact either in local elections, school boards or city councils or mayor's offices, or with the exception of maybe Florida, where there's a large amount of population at a federal level. It's not clear, based on electoral data, that they're turning up to the polls. A lot of folks expected more Puerto Rican presence in the last round of elections in 2018.
Which was so narrowly won by the Republican governor and the Republican senator that it could have made a difference. Yeah,
they could have. So based on that electoral data, it's not clear that Puerto Ricans are making a difference. They could, but they're not doing it.
Well, Charles Venator Santiago, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Venator Santiago, who's professor of Latino politics, public law, and political theory, who holds a joint appointment with the Department of Political Science and the Institute for Puerto Rican and Latino Studies at the University of Connecticut. And his forthcoming book is Less Than Equal, A History of the Extension of U.S. Citizenship to Puerto Rico. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with an expert on Saudi Arabia about Jared Kushner's appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee today and the chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee's demand for a briefing on what went on in the secret meetings Jared Kushner had with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Ali. And, of course, today Jared Kushner was questioned again by the Senate Intelligence Committee. We don't know what was said for obvious reasons. It's all done in secret. But what we've sort of learned through the cracks is that they were asking him both about his relationship with Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi Crown Prince, and also his meetings in 2016 during the transition period, I think December the 10th or the 12th, where he met secretly with the Russian ambassador Kislyak and the head of a bank known as Putin's Slush Fund, where Kushner apparently set up a back channel between the White House and the Kremlin, along with asking for a half a billion dollars to bail out his building at 666 Fifth Avenue. Now, on top of that, the House Chairman Elliot Engel of a key House committee is demanding a briefing from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Jared Kushner's recent trip to Saudi Arabia, where senior State Department officials and other diplomats were banned from attending the meeting, which is the normal protocol. So let's start with that. What do you know about that meeting that took place last month between Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Jared Kushner, at which the U.S. ambassador and other officials were banned?
This meeting goes to prove that there are channels that are beyond the reach even of the U.S. government. So I do not have any information of what has took place in that meeting, but this gives you an idea of what type of relationship some American officials currently and previously, maybe even in the future, have with the Saudi monarchy. And these usually are not state-related. They are mostly personally related. That involves definitely exchange of money and funds to benefit these American officials one way or another, directly or indirectly. And that has been the story of these type of meetings for the past, I would say, 35 years, since the time of Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi billionaire arms dealer, who used to boast about bringing in cash to Washington and handing that cash to American officials. So this has been an ongoing problem within Washington and the United States and with the UK as well, that these type of operation on paper are illegal, but they happen all the time and continue to happen. So this is probably one of those cases. There's no need for a secretive meeting between these two men, between MBS and Kushner, that the U.S. should not know about, the U.S. government. So that tells you that there is something wrong, that is something suspicious and maybe even unlawful that's taken place. We will never know.
Well, the Daily Beast reported on Wednesday that the Department of Energy had approved six authorizations for U.S. companies seeking to conduct nuclear-related work in Saudi Arabia. And we know that that was in what George Nader, the convicted child molester, was brokering along with Tom Barak. That, on the surface, doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would the U.S. give top-secret nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia? Do you know what's going on there?
This sort of brings back the story of the AWACS. That happened in the 1980s. The AWACS are these planes that fly in the sky and that can see. And you don't need a satellite. These are basically flying satellites that could see what happens on the ground. And there was a lot of opposition to it during the Reagan time. And they were approved for some reason. It turned out that it was approved because people were paid. And I think here we have a very similar scenario where this kind of technology or the spread of nuclear technology that the U.S. openly is starving the Iranian nation because of that, because of such accusation, is doing the opposite. So really this creates a credibility issue for the United States. And on one hand, they don't want the Iranians to have any nuclear technology, but they are giving that technology, or similar technology, to Saudi Arabia. So that is really an issue that I think will come to bite the United States in the future. The Saudi regime, if it does not survive, then what? Well, then maybe you have another regime or a government that's not going to be friendly to the United States. And then the U.S. might end up sanctioning that regime because not because of nuclear energy, because it just happened to not be a U.S. Ally or a proxy.
Well, I don't know why Saudi Arabia needs nuclear energy. I mean, what's going on there?
Is it? They don't need. We don't need in our country nuclear energy because we need other things, number one, that are much more pressing, and that is basic infrastructure. We do not have, for example, in the city of Riyadh, the capital city of Riyadh, we don't have public transportation. We don't have mail service. And most of the Riyadh city does not have a basic infrastructure of sewage. So most homes in that city, 80% plus of these homes, rely on septic tanks to dispose of their human waste. So this is a much more important issue than having nuclear energy at this time or nuclear technology. Basic services have not been delivered in most of the country. And I think these are the areas where the United States should be helping, not giving nuclear technology to a country that cannot even run a bus service.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. So I'm trying to get a handle on this relationship between Jared Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman. Prior to, of course, the first thing that happened when Trump became president was that King Salman, the father, who's apparently got dementia or oncoming dementia, he gave Jared Kushner's wife, Trump's daughter, Ivanka, $100 million for her foundation. And I'm not sure what Ivanka's charitable foundation does, and the Trump family in general are not famous for their charitable instincts. But so subsequent to that, we know that about a week after Jared Kushner had visited with Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince then arrested a bunch of wealthy Saudis and other prominent Saudis, put many of them in the Ritz Hotel. Many of them were tortured, and most of them had their fortunes confiscated. There is a great deal of rumors swirling around that Kushner may have provided MBS with information or even lists of the Crown Prince's critics abroad, including Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered. What do you know about that?
Again, this is another one of those meetings that the U.S. government itself does not know about, so I would not claim to know what happened. It is extremely likely that any information that the Saudi Crown Prince MBS asked out of Kushner would be given to him, including any secret or classified information, because Mr. Kushner had access to it. And it is, again, very likely. This is not restricted to Mr. Kushner. This has happened before as well. If you look in the past, Bill Clinton received tens of millions of dollars from the Saudi government. Jimmy Carter received $35 million for his center. And some other people did. McCain received $1 million check from the Saudi embassy. And it was based on a conversation that he had with Adel Joubert, the Saudi ambassador at the time in Sedona, Arizona. So this fits that pattern of Saudi Arabia paying American officials, current and former officials, millions of dollars to get something out of them. Sometimes just a promise of getting paid makes a difference, and it does make a difference. People think, oh, because of this guy, he's a president of the United States, he will never be influenced by Saudi money. That's not true. Everybody is a human here, and they are influenced by the prospect sometimes, not by the actual, but the prospect of getting tens of millions of dollars or millions of dollars to into their account, personal or their foundation, just like what we saw with Miss Trump. She will never criticize the Saudi government because they gave her tens of millions of dollars for her foundation. So this is the way that the Saudi Arabia and other monarchies in the Gulf have been buying America's leaders, to be very frank.
Well, just in closing, though, we know that the intelligence community did not want to give Jared Kushner a intelligence clearance, and the president forced their hand. And it was so alarming to the chief of staff in the White House, General Kelly, and the White House counsel, Don McGahn, that they wrote memos for the record saying they opposed giving Jared Kushner the security clearance. And that must have been based upon intelligence intercepts. So it's, to my mind, it's pretty likely that there's some evidence that Jared Kushner did communicate with MBS. What the contents of those communications are, apparently U.S. intelligence has them. And if he was testifying today before the Senate Intelligence Committee, presumably they may have some of that information. Wouldn't that be logical?
I think so. I mean, it's the responsibility of the U.S. Congress, the Senate, to investigate and ensure. This is their job. That's why the American people elected them, to guard against the overreach of government and the violation of the U.S. government, even of people who are not U.S. citizens but live on U.S. soil, like Mr. Khashoggi was. And there is a possibility that Mr. Khashoggi was given assurances by certain U.S. officials that he would be okay. And at the same time, the Saudis were given information about him by Mr. Kushner or others. I'm not sure, but the likelihood is there, unfortunately. We cannot rule it out. And that is, I think, was what is most disturbing. I have seen evidence of in other cases that I cannot elaborate on, but of people who they were given, basically, the U.S. government gave the Saudi information about them. And the Saudi government used that information against them. And these people live in the United States. And that has been the case not only in Saudi Arabia, but in different Gulf countries, where the U.S. provided information, negative information, about individuals, activists, who were arrested and sometimes murdered by these regimes. So this is something I hope the U.S. Senate and Congress will take seriously. I'm not sure if that we will see that day, but I hope so, that it will happen.
Well, Ali Lamed, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Lamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with the man she loved.
fire.